Hi everyone, this is Twisted Preservation and 10 Minutes at the Water Cooler, and I'm Frank Vagnone. Today we've got Elon Cook, who is Program Manager and Curator at the Center for Reconciliation and Humanities Director at the Robbins Historic House. Thanks so much, Elon, for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, as I joke, this is the speed dating of podcasts, because none of us have much time to listen to these things. So, you know, I just jump right in and ask you the questions. The first thing I'd like for you to do is to kind of self-identify in terms of culture, race, ethnicity. Just tell everyone how you identify yourself.
I identify myself as a Black American woman.
Great. Now, do you think your involvement with museums is related to you self-identifying as a Black American woman? And if so, in what ways has your interaction with the museum field been affected by this identity?
My identity as a Black American woman has had an enormous impact on the field that I've gone into and the way that I've gone straight into African American history, the African American experience, and spent a lot of time focusing on the black female experience. I grew up in a family that was constantly talking, usually telling stories about family history or individual history, especially my parents. So I grew up being very focused on what happened before me. And I found that the more that I understood about my friends, my family members, and what happened in their early lives or what happened in our familial past, the more I understood who these individuals were and how that affected me and how I became who I am. When I got out of college and then out of grad school and was looking for jobs, I really just wanted to work at a museum, and I realized that the fact that I went to a historically Black college, the fact that a lot of my internship work was at African-American historic sites and museums, and my research was really all focused on African-American history. So even though I live in Rhode Island right now and there are no Black history museums here, I needed to find a job at a non-Black history site, or at least that's what I thought. And I could not find anything. And slowly but surely, I randomly kind of networked my way into organizations that were specifically looking for someone with my research background in African American history, and who could also speak from the Black experience about race and about slavery and about history in general.
Let's go back just a little bit. And so, you said you kind of couldn't find the position that you wanted in, the, as you called it, the kind of non-Black museums, right?
Like I thought that was the only thing I could get in Rhode Island and in the southern part of Massachusetts, just the area where I'm in. There were no Black history sites. So I didn't think I could get a job doing Black history because there didn't appear to be anything here. And then it just so happened that there were brand new organizations that popped up. They were looking for someone like me, and I was looking for something like them. So it ended up being the perfect matching that suddenly just occurred.
But now when people of color say that the museum field really does marginalize their voices, what's your response to that?
I definitely agree. It's marginalization, but it's also a lot of people in the museum field talk about it as ghettoization. It's not just that we're being pushed to the side, but we're being pushed to the side to only speak to an experience in the history that is considered less important by the public and a lot of times by the board of an organization or by the higher-ups, our bosses. And so we kind of get trapped sometimes in doing that work at maybe traditional historic sites or traditional museums. You go to a historic house, especially a plantation house, and a lot of them, they do not want to talk about slavery. They do not want to talk about African-American history. And it can be really hard to push for the addition of that perspective and that narrative when it was always there. We just want it to be available for the public to see. So it's a combination of the visitors sometimes not wanting or being afraid to talk about it, and the staff and board not wanting to have any kind of focus on this kind of history. So it does kind of feel like sometimes it's actually ghettoizing this Black history. It's making it seem lesser.
Well, let's talk about that for a bit, because a lot of people talk about the kind of cultural and social privilege found in the leadership of museums. So the kind of straight white male leaders.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting for you to kind of expand on that for me, how you see that leadership level, does it exist, as people are saying? And the next question is, you know, how do you, what's something that leadership level should do right now to increase diversity?
I think there's a couple of things going on. For one, there is definitely the straight white male leadership that is at the vast majority of museums and historic sites across the country. And then usually directly below them are straight white women, usually. And I've often seen that because Black people and white people are still not really networking and connecting with each other, so it perpetuates the hiring practice of continuing to only bring in more and more white staff. And a lot of times I find that the hiring managers, they don't know where to go to bring in staff of color because they just don't have the network. I was talking to a friend who is working, she has a friend who works at an African-American historic site that's brand new, and it's mostly white staff. And the problem is they don't know who to talk to find the Black network of professionals who are finishing their masters and their PhDs and who are working in the field already and who are looking for jobs. So I think it's a combination of the staff who are already working there not knowing how to find people of color who want to do this job, and then because people of color have been traditionally felt excluded from this history, from these sites, a lot of young people don't even realize that these are careers that are open and available to them. And then there's also the fact that the humanities, there's very little money in the humanities. So your parents are pushing you to become a doctor, to become a lawyer, to get a very traditional job with a lot of money. And so it's a privilege to work in the humanities. It's a privilege to get a master's degree. It's definitely a privilege to get a PhD. And so there's fewer people of color who are getting these degrees. And if you're only hiring people with a PhD, and there are very few people of color getting PhDs, it's kind of it's hard to get that match between the people who want the job and the people who are hiring for the job.
No, that's a really interesting idea, and that is because it's very real and easy to solve. It's just quite simply a kind of distribution of a job description to the right papers, to the right networks,
mm-hmm.
Through
mm-hmm.
social media. I mean, I think social media has probably helped us a lot, correct? Because there's really not a kind of as strong racial boundaries, economic boundaries to social media. So it would be interesting as an idea to see if there could be a networking set up, very much like Museum U has done with Monica Montgomery, and that is to find people of color for museum positions to become the kind of go-to place. So that's an interesting idea that you have.
Well, I think it's also networking, mentoring.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get both of my organizations, and we're slowly starting to do it, to reach into the local high schools to connect with the local communities of color and bring in Black and brown students and even Asian students to bring them in, to go and connect with the local immigrant communities, bring them in for internships. Some of the lower level jobs that we're slowly starting to hire for, and then help work people up through the ranks. you really do not need a PhD to do most museum work. A master's degree is very, very helpful. And having the on-the-job skills is incredibly, incredibly helpful. So I think if we start young people off as high schoolers, start them off as college students, showing them that there are careers here, that you can have a stable life, you can get health insurance,
right.
that you can really fall in love with this kind of career, and then make sure that they get in. So it's kind of sharing the privilege of already being in these positions with people who don't even know that it's there or may know it's there but don't know how to access it. So I really think it's mentoring, mentoring, mentoring too.
Oh, that's great. That's exactly why I set up the Koch Fellowship in my previous job. It was just, and I sought out people of color because the opportunities just weren't there. I didn't exclude anyone else, but I also made a point to advertise in those avenues that I didn't normally know myself. I asked people. And so that's real. That's a really great point. Now, one thing, and I think you've heard me say this over and over again, is that most historic houses and sites don't deal with present news. They really shy away from politics. And on the front page of today's paper, it reads, Trump takes aim at trade pacts and globalism. And I'm really interested in kind of your perspective on how this grassroots international move away from this notion of globalism will affect the museum field. Because even with what you're doing and everything we've talked about in the last 10 minutes, it is about kind of connecting and making the network wider. And in some ways, the trend seems to be moving in the opposite direction. I'm really interested in your perspective on that.
Well, one thing we do, because you're right, we're not really supposed to talk about politics. But I also see the whole, the personal is political, and we sort of play with that. So we make connections to the history and use that to talk about what's going on right now. So we, at both of my historic organizations, we talk about slavery, for instance. So when we talk about the Underground Railroad, we don't just talk about people liberating themselves from slavery or running away from Georgia or Maryland. We talk about people being refugees from slavery, from that the refugee experience, leaving your home, leaving your family, coming to a new place where maybe people don't understand you, where maybe you don't understand them. What is that experience like? And then also connecting the different immigrant waves in the same way that we hear Trump making all these really ugly comments about Mexicans. You go back far enough in time and those exact same labels are going to the Polish, to the Irish. I mean, if you were talking to an American Indian back in the 1600s, he may have had some of the same thoughts about British colonists that we have right now about Latinos and about Muslims. So we try and get people to think about the broader context of the history and the fact that a lot of this stuff that we're talking about right now, we've been through several times before and we clearly didn't learn from it. And that's why we're going through it again. So maybe we talk to each other honestly about what we've already done and maybe we should not be doing these horrible things to the new people who are coming here. Maybe we should be more open and welcoming because all of these new people coming in, they're bringing new technology. They're bringing new cultural aspects that may actually improve our culture. They're bringing new words that maybe make our ability to speak to each other more accurate. So I like to use the history to kind of help poke holes in some of the crap that people say right now.
And that's why I wanted to talk with you by the water cooler today, Eon. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
you're
you
welcome.
Taking the time to do this. And everyone, please remember that you can't find the answers if you don't ask the questions. Thanks again, Eon.
Thank you.